Welcome to our Agile Tales, where we share the various successes and trials we've encountered as we navigate corporate levels and political waters to transform the business to be adaptable to this forever changing world.
Today, we have a special guest with us, Joe Justice. Joe works globally as an interim executive for Agile organizations, bringing multinational companies twice the work in half the time. He's a TEDx speaker and a guest lecturer at both MIT and Oxford University in England. In 2006, he applied Agile to automotive manufacturing, founded Team Wikispeed, and set four world records. Joe joined Tesla in 2020, where he operated Agile Tesla from the company headquarters. Let's welcome Joe as we bring him on to explore Agile at Tesla.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for being in another episode of our Agile Tales, where we're going to explore Agile at Tesla. Shall we dive right in?
Absolutely, Munwei. It's my honor, privilege, and pleasure to be here. JF, fantastic to be working with you. Let's have a good time and see if we can't get some really good information recorded into the podcast.
We will do that. Yes. I have questions about suppliers and government certification people. Are they part of Tesla teams too? Are they all on site every day and work on teams?
Some suppliers are. And I want to give Toyota a huge amount of credit for this. Toyota, they weren't the first company to do this, but they did do it at massive scale and still do. They have what's called Toyota City in Nagoya, Japan, and it is called Toyota City, and the suppliers are there. A lot of people don't realize this, even when lean practitioners go to visit Toyota City, which is like a pilgrimage many lean practitioners do. Still, a lot of the time, they don't notice. The suppliers are in the building. That is the supplier building. Or they're in the next building, like 10 meters over, with a rail track that they can deliver mass carts on. I mean, they're physically co-located. That's what it means to be a Toyota supplier. The only reason they're a supplier and not Toyota is anti-monopoly laws. I mean, Toyota is a monopoly. It's government supported. That said, they really do take care of people. In a way, they are Social Security. So I'm not saying it's as bad as you might think. It's actually in some ways awesome. But they are a monopoly, and those are artificially suppliers. They really are all Toyota. In a way, I mean, they're related, it like by blood and marriage, like all of it, definitely politically. But in any case, they're co-located. That's what it means to be a Toyota supplier. You are in the building, or you don't have to go in the rain if it's raining to deliver these just-in-time parts. And the concept of just-in-time is a little strange because those suppliers are contracted and paid to warehouse parts. So if there's a shortage, they have slack that they can deliver. It's just-in-time to the line, so the line stays smooth, clean, efficient. It doesn't mean you don't have a store. It's right there. They call it supplier. In America, we got that all wrong. We're like, well, my supplier in China has a stock of parts, and now there's a freighter that's sideways in the Suez Canal. It's 18 months to get here, but that's my supplier just in time delivering stock. No, no, no. It's a little different. Think of it as cartridges right next to the line. That comes from the original Toyota concept of visiting an American supermarket after World War II and getting a gallon of milk, and the next gallon slides down. That's just in time. That's your supplier. Your supplier is that cartridge of milk gallons. That's the Toyota model from the American post-World War II supermarket. Toyota really did expand that. We were doing it, we in America, in supermarkets, not in our manufacturing. Toyota really grew that, blew that up, that idea of suppliers. Tesla absolutely does the same thing. Suppliers are on site where they have very fast service level agreements, or Tesla has to do it in-house. A example that I can talk about, it's in Ashley Vance's biography on Elon Musk. SpaceX needed to make rocket motors that are going to cram rocket fuel into the combustion chamber. They're basically F1 engines. They're some of the highest horsepower to weight things on planet Earth or space. And SpaceX needed some of these to start. So they put out bids for suppliers. The few bids they got back from the few companies that said, we'll make one for you, were several years lead time, and they were very expensive. SpaceX said, we don't have several years, and that price is disrespectful. we didn't want to make rocket fuel pumps ourselves, but we have to. So that's what forces insourcing. It's not like Musk wanted to be vertically integrated. Musk still does not want to be vertically integrated if you watch the actions of the company. Musk has no choice because many areas of the supply chain are desert or inefficient. So if you want to be an efficient company, that means you need a supplier that meets your service level agreement. If that doesn't exist, that drives insourcing. Well, the service level agreement also drives suppliers to come to you and work inside the facility. There's a story about that, but I think we said it in podcast 2, which was about changing from stamping to casting and the supplier coming on site. For government officials and certifications, it's the same. For a normal company, a normal slow company, when they've finished a new product introduction cycle and they're ready for type certification, for homologation, for legal use approvals, they will contact the government agency for testing and validation because they're ready. In a traditional company, that's 5, 7, 14 years. So of course, they don't have a regular cadence of relationship on this product with the government agency. The request comes from out of the blue. So they get put in a queue and the government agency then gets to them when they do. It takes about a year in many cases, and then they do type certification testing and they pass or fail, and then we do it again. It actually iterates whether people want it to or not. If they fail, that triggers an iteration. Whether they had planned for an iteration or for one waterfall release, doesn't matter. Reality is still reality. In Tesla, every single car is potentially unique. So what Tesla does is they invite the certification authority for each car. This has been going on for so many years now, for more than a decade, that the government officials know that's what happens today again, like every day, and they just come directly into Tesla. They actually watch the certification tests, and they do homologate and type certify each car. It's not because there's some special relationship. It's because that's how often they're requested, through the same request method as anyone else, because that's the pace of new product introduction.
So how did Tesla initially get the government in at the beginning? I mean, it had to start somewhere.
The Roadster wasn't as fast to market. It was fast. It was shockingly fast, but it was like 2.5 years to market fast. So that's enough time to engage in a standard certification process, which is largely what happened. Now, Roadster version 2, remember when they called it version 2, they made a big deal? And no one even calls it Model S version 2, even though there's been more than 100 major versions. But Roadster was new enough that they called it version 2. So that went through testing again, and then version 3. Well, now the government agencies get it. They're like, okay, every day is new versions. We get it. And
wow. So you train them, basically. You train government to be fast. I wish we could do that.
The government largely wants to aid innovation. And there are special deals and all kinds of weirdness, like anything. But on the whole, the government wants innovation and a competitive product that's safe in the market as soon as responsible. In general, the government wants that. So the government, it's not like they're saying, slow down, GM, slow down, Ford, slow down, Stellantis, in the United States, for example, or in Europe even, slow down, Daimler, slow down, BMW. They're just used to getting a contact every 4 to 7 years per model. They're just used to that. So of course it's shocking if some nimble startup starts to do it faster, but it's not like they didn't want it. It's just new. Well, it's not new anymore for Tesla. It's been more than 10 years. So now it's just normal, but it's not like the government is like, you're moving too fast. Not in general. I mean, there are some special interests and they are corrupt and there's billions of dollars on the line. That's real. That's normal. One out of every 100 people is 100% bad. And one out of every 100 people is 100% good. That's the world we live in. Play the odds, try to smile at everybody is how I try to live it.
That's very interesting. You mentioned before that there is no central procurement, but there is a central database or poster on the wall of who and what supplier is the best supplier at this time. So
yes,
that's correct. Okay. In traditional companies, procurement departments ensure that the best deals usually are when buying in bulk. So yes, when it is a team that purchases, wouldn't the company be spending more in this case?
Mm. okay, there's agile contracts. By that, all I'm trying to say, I'm not trying to introduce some funky buzzword. All I'm trying to say is it may be a long relationship with a vendor, but it's split into paid deliveries. And there is allowed for design change or feedback, modification, which usually means design change, at each of these deliveries. And I'll call those sprints. So there is, in some cases, large bulk agreements with specific suppliers, because the suppliers wish for that. Now they can tool up, they can invest in delivering these goods. That's actually respectful to them. What Tesla needs is to not have it be, let's say it's a 10-year supplier contract. I mean, probably doesn't go that long, but let's say it is. What they don't want is to get 10-year-old designs 10 years from now. So they have this regular cadence of inspect and adapt, and that gets shorter as the supplier can take it, all the way down to 3 hours in the case of the mega casting dies and injection molds. From a supplier, every 45 minutes, new dies, which is unheard of. Yes, that's ludicrous. It's split into inspect and adapt points that I'll call sprints, where the design can be changed and then some are delivered. There's never an inspect and adapt point without a delivery. So it's not like design is changed as parts are being made. Finish making those parts. Then let's change the design for the next batch. And how fast a batch can be designed, made, and tested determines the sprint length. Of course, shorter is better, but that is what it is.
Got it. That explains things. You also mentioned company as a service, and these are teams that include coffee teams, facilities, funding teams, and gourmet teams. I know that term is made up, company as a service, but are there any company as a service teams aside from those that I mentioned?
Yes. Anything that's not a module team is arguably a company as a service team. So there is HR, which we talked about in session two, that would be like a company as a service team. And then there's production HR, which we talked about in podcast two, for those who want to go deep. Then there is coffee and gourmet and facilities and funding team. There is legal. You can have distributed legal, but there absolutely is legal at tesla.com, where you can get fast responses and it's monitored by a rotating team. So that's a company as a service. There's lean at Tesla. There's agile at Tesla. There's interest groups too that form a service, at least to people of that interest. So there's like Latinos at Tesla and Tesla Latino tweets, but I don't know if Tesla Latino is associated with Latinos at Tesla, for example. And that is a service to people who choose to identify with that community, which, by the way, isn't limited to ethnicity or anything. It's by people who choose to identify with that community. That's what I can think of off the top of my head.
Got it. Let's go back to my favorite, the gourmet team. What do they do? Do they provide breakfast and lunches at the set time? Do they provide dinner too?
I will say what the aspiration is. And I'll say that during COVID times, it was more challenged. It was more limited. The aspiration is Michelin 3-star quality food, hot every 3 to 4 hours, 24 hours a day. Nice. That's the aspiration. There's a number of very useful human factors reasons as to why. The top of my mind as an agilist as to why that's worth the spend is if absolutely the best food in town is here, you save time. You don't need to get into a car. And the real benefit is it doesn't break context. So say I'm swarming with a group of 4 people on a more efficient heat pump. That's an example I like to use because it's public. I can talk about that one. Well, if you're getting hungry, no one wants you with low blood sugar making decisions or lifting heavy things or driving a fork truck. So they want you, before that happens, to have healthy, absolutely delicious food. Everybody wants that, including you probably. If that's there, you have a choice to go as a team and never break context. Yes, you're not in touching distance of the machinery making the heat pump anymore, but you're not far from it. You might even still be able to see it, depending on, because there's really nice cafeterias. I could call it a cafeteria, but that's different than what I grew up thinking a cafeteria was. These things have all these live plants potted in composting coffee from the coffee team. It's fashionable. It's very nice. Yes, you're in there with like some glue smeared across your work glove that's like wadded on the table. Your face mask is here and you're putting it back on between bites or whatever. You might be in the work and looking like you're in the work, but it's a very fashionable space. These rolling glass walls is pretty cool. Now, whether the food was Michelin 3-star quality when I was there, everybody's trying the best they can with what they have that day.
Nice. Aside from world-class coffee and round-the-clock Michelin quality food, are there any other perks you would like to share?
I think they're called Otter Pops. There's those frozen popsicle pops. Those are handed out like candy. You can have it because it's hot in the summer and you can just have those go. The real perk is being in the machine that builds the machine. And I really can't describe easily how absolutely cool it feels to be in these facilities, much less to be empowered in them, not just an observer. You are inside a robot. I don't mean to cheapen that. There's stories where I actually was inside a robot. Some of those I don't get to talk about yet, but in general, the larger factory is a lot like a fairly intelligent AI robot. It's becoming an alien dreadnought, and you're in there. I recently got scuba diving certified, like we talked about Munwe and JF. And there's this experience when you dive for the first time, trying to figure out how do you, you know, equalize and all that, but where the world becomes more three-dimensional than it usually is. There's stuff happening above, below, behind you. There's a shark, and I wasn't attacked or anything. Sharks just in general, I think, do their shark thing. It's almost 100% safe, almost. There's a shark. And I was extremely interested and a little nervous because I'm new to this whole thing. And there is a shark, and not that small a one. It wasn't a great white. It was a white reef shark. They tell me, or white tipped reef shark, something. It wasn't small. It was bigger than me. And that's my definition of, should I be concerned? Well, that can be above you. It can be below you. It can be on any side. There's this reorientation that in a way feels more alive because suddenly it's not just floor. I know to enlightened people, it's never just floor. I mean, don't get me wrong. You can live your whole life that way. Inside Tesla, it's like that. I mean, one, there are robots above and below you and to the side. It truly is three-dimensional, but it's changing all the time. I happen to like cars. So there's all these beautiful cars everywhere. And I happen to love the environment. So I felt in tune with the mission. So all of that only amplified it, but it's so flipping awesome to just be there, much less be trying to improve it in any way. Absolutely meaning of life level fulfilling all the time. And that's valuable.
Wow, that's pretty nice as a perk to be inside an AI dreadnought, as you so put it. But let me go back a little bit to Earth and let's talk about something that everybody, I think, might be interested, and that is pay. As you said, pay is just over minimum wage. And even with the perks for folks in California, how do they survive with that little money?
Okay, I love the company. This is an experiment in social creation. Here's what's actually going down. This is part of what could be much more awesome about the company and part of what is the most awesome about the company. You're making $19.50 an hour or something like that. Almost everybody is. And you're in the Bay Area. So how does this work? You want to be buying into the stock plan as hard as you possibly can, because that's where the upside is. It's very clear and it's very generous. You get an awesome employee benefit over someone who's not an employee. You can get rich quick in Tesla, quickly. And many people do. But how do you live in the meantime? How does that work? There's some people like me who treated this as a sabbatical. I had money. I didn't have to use my Tesla income to pay anything. I lived on my own expenses, but I did track that as an experiment. I tried to live comfortably, but very Spartan. I knocked out what I thought were all my discernible luxuries. I tried to live only on the Tesla salary and not touch anything I had before. I broke even. I was in the Bay Area. The Bay Area is super expensive, but I broke even. I was cooking my own meals. That was shopping at non-brand name grocery store. And I had my car paid off. If I had a car payment, that would have been tough. Luckily, it was a Tesla, so I had no gas bill. That was also in my favor. And it was still break even. That's tough. So how do people do it? there's a lot of people that carpool in from living in a shared RV in the desert. And no joke. So when it's 120 degrees Fahrenheit, that's their RV. That's what they're going to come back to. It's several of them sharing it. A lot of people like that. And their carpool, when you're far enough out that you can basically park your RV for almost for free, that's more than a 2-hour drive each way. The shifts are 12 hours. It's good if you can come in a certain amount of time early to go upstream of where you think you're going to be working that day, and even stay a little late to go downstream of where you spent most of your time that day and connect more of the mental puzzle so you can be better at your job. You don't have to, but I did, and I loved it. That was actually one of my most favorite parts of working there, is that I could do that. Well, then you've got a 2-hour drive in and a 2-hour drive out. In their case, I stayed the 8-minute or less drive away at a Marriott Residence Inn, but with a bulk rate for a long stay, it was extremely cheap. It was actually extremely cheap for the Bay Area. It was cheaper than many apartments, and I was at break even. These folks had that additional time lag. That, in a sense, some of the problems that do come up and Tesla is accused of, like it takes too long to go to the bathroom, so someone might pee in a trash can. That's awful. It's unhuman. You might not have a choice time-wise. That kind of thing could happen. I think Giga Texas and Giga Berlin have really changed the bones. They don't have to build on the legacy plant that Toyota and GM had made, which really does compromise the Fremont facility. The other thing, and part of the reason Tesla did move their headquarters to Texas, is cost of living is radically less in Texas. It's less than half. So the same wage, you can be saving. You can be saving a lot, and you can be buying Tesla stock, and you can be buying a Tesla the same wage. I think that's part of the benefit for a lot of people. Now, weirdly, housing hasn't done the obvious choice, which is to have a Tesla product. It's basically the Tokyo model, where no matter what you pay, it's safe, it's clean. It's just the size that's throttled by money. Well, it looks like it's McMansions being rolled out across Texas, saying the Tesla employees are going to buy these, and they don't even have solar roofs on them. I mean, they're not even all single slope facing south, ready for a solar roof. They're like the most complicated McMansion shape that's awful for solar. Solar will work on them, but by an aesthetic choice, they've reduced solar generation by half. So there's not housing designed with Tesla employees in mind. Now, a McMansion is affordable for a Tesla employee. A 3,000, 5,000 square foot home in Texas is so cheap that you can buy it. But I don't even know if that's what many of these people want. The housing mix isn't meeting the massive employment blitz that's happening in Texas right now. It should be 5-over-1 solar on top, retail underneath, and parking for your Cybertruck. And that's it. I mean, it should be really nice row homes with glass balconies. If you think of the Tesla design aesthetic, that product aesthetic, there's something that fits that. That's what working in the mothership is like. And it looks like Tesla Austin looks even more like that. So housing that matches that, it feels like you're going back in time, going to a drywall McMansion with Burberry carpet floors. It's just ridiculous. Anyway, there was a lot of my opinion too, but Musk is attempting to take over the labor market with TeslaBot, truly full on, reinvent currency, reinvent labor. The aspirations are all of it, win at all of it, like reinvent what it means to be conscious. If Tesla succeeds, or Musk really, in any part of that, then traditional trading your time for money is irrelevant. The Tesla bots are going to do a lot of that. Autobidder already takes over a lot of technical jobs inside the Musk companies, and it's available. It's a leased technology already, so other companies can take advantage of that AI stack, and that'll only grow. So the idea of universal basic income is something Musk likes. Musk says it publicly, and as the idea of universal healthcare. So just by being born, just by being alive, you have a living wage, no matter what you do, whether you work or don't work or whatever, just because you are alive, you have a living wage and you have healthcare, period. Done. Musk runs that experiment in Tesla and all the Musk properties. You get essentially universal basic income to work there. Then you have the opportunity to invest and become a billionaire, at least millionaire, by putting anything into the stock plan. It's not like you have to stay after work and go to a special meeting and sign all these forms. It's like a button on your phone. It's like, you really should do this. Please click this button. It's super easy. And it asks you all the time, you should really do this. This is a really good idea. It's not manipulative. It's easy, is what I'm trying to say. It's not like some companies where it could be possible to buy in before the IPO, but you really had to know somebody and you had 45 minutes to do it because really they didn't want you to do it. It's not like that. To work in a Musk company, it is an experiment in universal basic income. I think that experiment is challenged in the Bay Area. I think that's one of the reasons why Musk is making much heavier bets in lower cost of living areas, because there the experiment looks like it's actually a really healthy experiment, whereas it's a really strained experiment. There's a YouTube video, so I'm not ratting anybody out, of someone living in their Model X in the Tesla parking lot to work there. They say, I was part of the team that innovated, designed, built, and continues to build these Model X's. I'm proud of this like it were my baby. This is a spaceship for Earth. So on my tiny, tiny salary, I saved up and bought one instead of renting an apartment. I live in it. And then I use the employee showers and I use the employee gym. And here's my bed. And here's how I do it. And they put it all on YouTube. I'd say they're not the only one that does that. Part of what makes that work is if you're not burning gasoline to run the air conditioning or heater, it's super quiet and super comfortable. My Model 3 is the nicest office I've ever had. And I've had luxury offices in Tokyo and New York City and et cetera. And my Model 3 is nicer. The temperature is always just right. The seats are the best seats I've ever sat in. The audio is perfect. It's wonderful. So I get it. I see why people could say, I could spend a lot of time in here. I see that. But you shouldn't have to live in your car. And that is a trade-off that people in the Bay Area sometimes make, or live in a shared RV in the desert. I met a lot of people that did that. It's tough. In Texas, I think you have a lot more options. In upstate New York, in Sparks, Nevada, even in Berlin, I think you have a lot more options.
Wow, this is definitely a very different way to operate and very different way of thinking about this.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're running out of time. So let's wrap this up and let's see if we can get Joe back to come again for our next round of questions.
That's all the time we have today. Next time, we'll pick up where we left off as we continue to explore Agile at Tesla with Joe Justice. You don't want to miss it.
Thank you so much for listening to our Agile Tales. Feel free to ping us on our agiletales.com.